I'd like to invite all of our presenters to the podium to take the questions. Dr. Ravi, Stefan. So we have speakers. We can hand in questions. Good. So maybe I could start by asking Dr. Agarwal a question about the blood pressure. You talked about the blood pressure pattern, which some patients are more healthy circadian dip, nocturnal dip. And in that case, if the patient does not have nocturnal dip, would that influence your target blood pressure in terms of the medication management?
So the question is about the nocturnal dipping. Really, the dipping is a moving target. You know, dipping can happen because your blood pressure during the day goes up and then it goes down during the night. But say if you put people in a wheelchair and they're not active during the day and they're bed bound, there's not going to be much dipping. Their blood pressure can be like 120 all the time without dipping. It just tells you that they are unhealthy. You know, if your sun doesn't rise and the sun doesn't set, it's a cloudy day. Nobody feels good. I don't know if we have ever proven that by simply changing the dipping phenomena can protect lives. I think if would be the underlying reasons that people don't dip would be more important. And perhaps one of the most important reasons why people don't dip is because they have underlying impairment in kidney function and albuminuria is associated with it. So yes, if you change that, perhaps people will have an improvement in outcomes. I don't know if we have proven yet that simply restoring the circadian rhythm by, say, changing the order of medication can restore health.
Any questions from the audience? Okay, we have one. Just to follow up on this, had you noted a dialysis patient with, let's say, sleep apnea? Would they lose the dipness that could be restored by doing some testing?
So, great question. So there's a lot of interest now in sleep apnea and its ability to restore cardiovascular health. And what we have learned from recent trials, predominantly done in Australia, that if you restore sleep through intervention like CPAP or BiPAP devices, you can improve sleepiness, daytime sleepiness and quality of life, but not so much cardiovascular health. So perhaps there was a presentation yesterday in American Heart Association about the same issue about restoring cardiovascular health by treating sleep apnea has been disappointing so far, but you can improve the quality of life and daytime sleepiness.
So there was a question from the audience. What are your thoughts about virtual care, telemedicine for nephrology in the future? I think it's a great that in general, technology is making us more and more comfortable with having close personal interactions without close geographic proximity. And so I think it's inevitable that it'll become more common, especially with the maldistribution of specialists in urban areas and increasing kidney disease in urban and especially southern hemisphere, Central America, CKDU type things. I think we'll see more and more of it.
There was a question that came regarding some of the work that I presented, and that is, are some of the biomarkers available for clinical use, or for that matter, are you able to get them measured if you're in a circumstance where you needed the levels? Unfortunately, in the United States, the routine availability of those assays for patient care purposes is not available. They're not FDA approved on any level. We have them, and a number of other labs in the United States have them for research purposes, and if you're interested from that standpoint, I'd be happy to help you if you want to send me an email. They are available, of course, in Europe and other parts of the world, but not in the United States.
So I have two questions here. What happens when you have blood pressure too low to ultrafilter? I think it's a common finding that as patients live longer on dialysis, say, for example, you go to your dialysis unit next week and year round, and you pick out the patients who have been on dialysis more than 10 years, you'll be hard-pressed to find a hypertensive patient. They will usually be in the 90 to 100 most of the time. Mistake we often make is that we can't ultrafilter those patients. Well, you know, the ultrafiltration is pretty simple. You calculate the intradialytic weight gain and you take it off. And that's what we do with these patients. And they might be coming in at 90 and they don't get hypotensive or have symptoms during hypotension. And they leave. And they've been doing it for tens of years. So I don't think that you can say that a starting blood pressure is too low, so don't remove fluid. In my view, a patient who is volume overloaded and hypotensive is worse than a person who is euvolemic and hypotensive. So which one do you want to have, a hypervolemic patient with low blood pressure or a person who is more at volume status with normal blood pressure? The second question I have is thoughts about pulmonary hypertension and blood pressure. I think that that's a very important point. We now are recognizing that pulmonary hypertension is a very important correlate of volume overload in dialysis patients. In fact, perhaps even more important than systemic hypertension. One in three dialysis patients has hypertension. Two out of three of them will have hypertension before they reach dialysis, but a lot of them become normotensive because of volume removal. Pulmonary hypertension, on the other hand, is there in about three-quarters of them, and it's really hard to treat. And even with kidney transplant, we have not been able to treat pulmonary hypertension. And now ongoing research is suggesting that pulmonary hypertension happens fairly early in the course of kidney disease. And why is it so? I think needs to be researched more. But perhaps one simple explanation of this would be is the response of the pulmonary blood vessels to chronic volume overload by vasoconstricting. And we perhaps need to be more aware of volume overload even before patients reach dialysis.
Stephanie?
Yes, so I have one question here. I don't know who wrote it, but whoever wrote it has a very nice handwriting, which I appreciate. That makes it easier for me. The question is, as far as the surprise question, are the results similar if you ask, would you be surprised if the patient was still alive? Versus if you ask, would you be surprised if the patient were no longer alive? And, you know, of those two alternatives, I would say most of the studies that I've seen ask, they're leaning towards one of those two ways of phrasing that. What I can say, though, is that we have, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, phrased it differently than most other studies have. And obviously, I haven't done a formal comparison, and I doubt that the sample size would be large enough there. But what I can tell you is that based off of the very small sample that we have there, our results seem to be very similar to what we've seen in the other studies on average. So, you know, if I had to make a guess, I would say there's probably not a huge difference depending on how you phrase it. But it's still a very legitimate question against the background of the points that I've made in my presentation. I think you have reason to believe that even subtle nuances like this might actually influence the results that you get. I have no evidence to support that there is any, at least not a significant difference. It appears that it's very similar, I would say.
Sure. Somebody asked the question, which is, does plasma exchange work? For example, for the management of preeclampsia, the standard plasma exchange we would otherwise give for some of the other diseases that we treat. Let me just summarize. So antihypertensive therapies, there have been over a dozen trials. They don't treat preeclampsia. They treat blood pressure, but preeclampsia is more than blood pressure. Dialysis, you can use that to manage volume. You can use that, obviously, to manage blood pressure. But it doesn't also treat or prevent or allow you to manage preeclampsia because preeclampsia is more than just blood pressure. And standard plasma exchange was actually tried in the 1990s, and the problems with plasma exchange were significant reduction in blood pressure, low blood flow to the placenta, and fetal compromise in combination with artificial blood products, which had to be given, of course, and so that type of treatment terminated. So the treatments that we are doing are gradient-based. They're not large changes in blood pressure, and so they're obviously targeting a single protein. But to my knowledge, none of the other extracorporeal therapies we have actually helps in preeclampsia.
So this question says, what about the relevance of crowdsourcing in nephrology? And so what I was trying to get at in my talk is that I really feel that what is going to replace UpToDate as the centerpiece of medical education is going to essentially be crowdsourced education. I personally think that the Wikipedia encyclopedia is one of the great achievements of mankind, and it's amazing that it was put together by a relatively unorganized a band of people all over the world. And it's remarkably accurate. I regularly take a look at Wikipedia entries in nephrology, and it's kind of a standard assignment of mine when I have medical students on rotations. Instead of asking them to do a 5-minute talk on some disease, I ask, which they'll just go to UpToDate, right, and copy the bullet points from there. What I do is I have them go to Wikipedia for what the disease they have, review the references, and update it. And that requires a little higher level thinking. It requires them to first not be familiar with their subject enough so they can critique an encyclopedia article, find the gaps, and then teach them that one of our jobs as physicians is to do this type of public education and maintain the commons at a high level of scientific certainty.
I think that's a key to keep the information accurate and objective. That requires lots of ongoing monitoring and support. Who is doing the maintenance? Who are these voluntary? Or?
Yeah, it's all voluntary. There have been some surveys of who does medical updates in Wikipedia, and it's usually doctors and people with pretty significant scientific backgrounds. In my experience, Wikipedia rarely has errors but has lots of omissions, that it's more incomplete than inaccurate. But there are inaccuracies and they need to be updated. But it's for what it is shockingly good.
That sounds good. Dr. Akawa?
So I have two questions. One is, how does the measurement of diastolic blood pressure or pulse pressure stake up in comparison to systolic blood pressure in hemodialysis patients as predictor of mortality or CV morbidity? To answer your question, I pulse pressure is a fairly potent marker of mortality in dialysis patients. There's actually, you can look at even routine pulse pressure, and it is. The problem is, what do you do with a pulse pressure? We don't treat pulse pressure. We don't have ways to raise the diastolic blood pressure or make the blood vessels more compliant. If you look at JNC guidelines, they tell us that after the age of 50, the target of treatment should be systolic blood pressure. And for CKD patients, the accelerated vascular aging is a pretty important phenomena. So even our younger patients have mostly systolic hypertension. In a person who's younger, I think diastolic blood pressure is reasonable to measure and to intervene. There'll be very few patients when we did ambulatory blood pressure monitoring. Isolated diastolic hypertension is only there in about less than 5% of the patients, about 3%. So either you're going to have combined systolic diastolic hypertension or isolated systolic hypertension. And perhaps that's a better way to manage the patients, is to not be so worried about the diastolic blood pressure, because systolic would be raised. Second question relates to, should you hold blood pressure medications prior to dialysis? And I think it's a great question. If you are administering hydralazine, yes, you should, because it's short-acting and it will plummet your blood pressure. If you are using short-acting nifedipine, you should stop using it and not use it at all. I don't use hydralazine at all because I think it plummets the blood pressure 3 times a day and lasts like 4 hours. So when we do ambulatory blood pressure monitoring and people are taking hydralazine, it's like you see a sawtooth pattern on the ambulatory blood pressure recordings, and probably that's not good for vascular health. The other culprit is alpha blockers. If you take an alpha blocker, and that you need the alpha receptors to vasoconstrict and protect the blood pressure during dialysis. So if you gave something like tamsulosin or doxazosin before dialysis, you are in big trouble. That's something you shouldn't do. The third thing which I've often seen is that when patients get chest pain and they get isosorbide under the tongue and the venoconstriction goes away, and the next thing you know is that you have a chest pain patient who has passed out. So you shouldn't do that during dialysis. Other than that, we use long-acting medications three times a week, atenolol, lisinopril. Both of them, they are dialyzed. They work pretty much over the entire interdialytic period, and they can be used fairly inexpensively. So we just administer them after dialysis three times a week.
Yeah, I just received a question about FOA med, but if you recall, that was in Dr. Topf's presentation, so I just passed that along to him.
Yeah, so do you think a foam med will eventually replace doctors? No. No, I mean, it's a tool, like just like Harrison's didn't replace doctors, just like UpToDate doesn't replace doctors. It's a tool for education. It is a tool that understands that the barrier to publication has dropped many orders of magnitude. Lots of people are talking about this. And so the population of people that are talking about medical education has expanded greatly. But not replace.
Yeah. So I that makes a lot of sense. Individual patients can be very different. For many centuries, we are still using stethoscopes. So from that standpoint, we still need to quite individualize our patients. I have these questions that are probably good for most of the audience and the presenters. How ethical is to start a dialysis for a patient who has a life expectancy of less than 6 months? Ravi, you want to take a...
I think you have to ask yourself that question. Would you want it or would you not? We do therapies in patients who have cancer, who have very limited survival. Pancreatic cancer is an example. I think that... if you just go by those metrics, a patient who has had, who has got diabetic nephropathy, who has got ESRD, and who has had an MI, has a survival that's worse than colon cancer, right? So should we be telling our patients that, look, your survival is like cancer? We don't. I mean, I think that I had a patient who had a lung mass, and he was... His functional status was completely fine, but he went and he got a diagnosis that he had a malignancy. And he told me he didn't want any therapy, but he wanted dialysis. And I work at the VA, and they said, I think it's a perfectly reasonable choice. When he went to the dialysis unit, they said, we're not going to dialyze you. You have cancer. I think that's a wrong thing to do. I believe that the patients have the right to make that decision whether they're making dialysis a choice that is benefiting them. He had two older kids, you know, they had come from out of town. They were very upset that he was refused dialysis. I think it's a mistake to not dialyze such patients who still have a reasonable quality of life and who wish to be dialyzed. And he can make a decision when the pain becomes too bad or something happens where he says, I don't want to have this therapy anymore. But I believe that the right of making a decision to dialyze is a mutual one. I don't think it's just a physician who's making a diagnosis and saying, you should be dialyzed or not dialyzed. I think it was that way when we had a committee of life and death in Seattle, you know, in the 1960s. But it's not that way anymore. I think dialysis has evolved, and I think we have to pay attention to the individual circumstances.
That's great. Stefan, Dr. Sisson, you have any thoughts?
Well, I agree with Dr. Agarwal. I mean, I think that was very, very well said. I don't think I have anything to add to that. And I mean, everybody's entitled to their own particular opinion on the subject, I guess, and I don't know how much the opinion of some other expert influences that, but I agree with particularly that you made that this is a mutual decision. This is something you want to get together and discuss.
Joe, you want
Yeah, I remember it was a number of years ago when Manula Tamura's article on dialysis survival in patients in nursing homes, and it was a bloodbath, right? Nursing home patients that get started on dialysis did horrible after a year, and soon after that, I had a patient come to me and wanted to know if they should start dialysis. They had profound uremia, they had severe Parkinson's, and I told them about this article and showed how poor it was, and I recommended that they not start dialysis. And they then met with their family and came back, and they said, "Doc, we really want to do this." And so they started on dialysis, and 6 years later, he was still doing great on dialysis. And every time I looked at him, I thought of that conversation, and I felt bad. And I just think it's a limit, or at least some humility that we need to add, that these studies look at means and averages, and every patient's an individual, and some will thrive.
I'll just echo that comment, and that is, you know, the diagnosis or the prediction of survival is always accurate in retrospect, and you know that's a fact.
That's great. We have a few questions related to the blood pressure control. These are very good questions. What's the principle to control the patient has a large fluctuation of blood pressure? How to do ultrafiltration when systolic blood pressure is less than 60? What's the further treatment above and beyond regular medication to achieve better blood pressure control? Due to the time constraint, our speakers will be around, and you can approach them with your questions. We will conclude the sessions now, and we can have a 15-20 minutes break. Thank you so much.